This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And still to come in the second half of Main Street, an effort to reduce the stigma and shame attached to addiction. But first, United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck has a new program this semester aimed at teaching students the science and art of growing healthy food. In its first semester, there are 4 enrolled members and 4 interns. Brian McGinnis is the land grant director and a faculty member in the Sustainable Ag and Food Systems program at UTTC. Linda Blackhelk is the Food Sovereignty Skills Coordinator. I recently sat down with both of them. What is a Food Sovereignty Skills Coordinator?
Basically, my job is to teach, to inform the public, our students here at United Tribes, about various ways to acquire traditional foods and not just identify traditional foods such as plants or various animals, but how do we harvest them in a good way, whether it's through fishing, hunting, or foraging? How do we prepare them? How do we store them long term? And then how do we finally prepare them and consume them?
Where did you learn this? Was this something that you grew up with, or was it something that came to you a little bit later and that you reached out and studied?
I learned most of what I know, I would say, from my grandmother. She practiced plant medicine, but also I've always been an outdoors kind of person. And so various people in my family and various friends would always take me out foraging, gathering, gardening, hunting, fishing, things like that.
What do you mean when you say plant medicine?
I suppose the Western term, the most popular Western term, would be herbalism, but that really doesn't cut it when it comes to indigenous knowledge about plants and medicine. We believe that plants are literally our relatives and they are our friends. We believe that they communicate with us, and I don't think that modern herbalism necessarily recognizes that. So a lot of times I actually use the term ethnobotanist rather than herbalist for myself.
Is it fair to say that the Western tradition strips the ceremony from the process?
I think that that's true in a lot of cases, not necessarily all of them. I know a lot of really wonderful herbalists out there who really recognize the spirituality behind plants and plant medicine. But one of my issues with a lot of herbalism is that people acquire plants without ever really knowing what those plants are, coming into contact with them, not ever having any idea what that plant looks like when it's growing. For my own practice as a healer, it's important to be out there praying with these plants, praying over them, and harvesting them myself.
You said that you learned this from your grandmother, and of course, we don't have to go very far back into this history of this land at all before we start to look at the destruction of traditional ways of the indigenous people of this land and the stripping away of the culture, of the language, of the food systems. How was it that your grandmother was able to keep this alive?
Well, I think that if you talk to anyone, I always say that everyone I talk to knows something. Even if it's just one small thing, they remember going out with their mother, their uncle, someone in their family took them out and taught something to them about our traditional foods, about our traditional medicine. I just talk to people. That's how I find the majority of my information, as I go and I visit with people. And I never underestimate the knowledge that one person can hold. I think often in communities, not just in indigenous communities, but all over the place, we have these certain people that we go to, these certain people we hold as knowledge holders, that we view as knowledge holders. Really, I think that in Lakota, they have a term called Ikjewichasha or Ikjewia, which just means a common person, just a regular everyday human being. And I believe that it's the Ikjewichasha and the Ikjewia who have some of the most valuable information. I love to go talk to them and visit with them.
How does this fit into your program?
Sort of the impetus for us having a sustainable agriculture and food systems program here at United Tribes is addressing issues of food sovereignty in indigenous communities specifically, but actually in addressing issues of food sovereignty everywhere. That's a big issue that we're talking about, food sovereignty. You know, how do we relate to our food? How do we have control over our food? Is our food appropriate to us? Is our food appropriate to us spiritually? Is it appropriate to us physically? What I've brought here is the ability to grow food. I'm a farmer. I can grow organic vegetables. That's my strong point. But obviously, the model where you have the one independent farmer who is pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and doing everything alone, and that is the keystone of our food system, is not a sustainable system in itself. Just that philosophy itself is, I think, the part of the trouble that we have in meeting the sort of demands of everybody, not just food security demands, but mind, body, spirit. How do we have sustainable communities that are fed in a sustainable way? I think that it's very important to not only think interdisciplinarily about it, you know, but also to bring in all the important voices. And obviously, ethnobotany, as an example, is just one important voice. And then obviously, Linda points out the other important voice is every single person's voice. How do we get everybody involved? We are involved in the food system, every single person, obviously, if we're eating. So how do we get the community involved? How do we get people energized and excited about food, whether it's growing food or whether it's just preparing food or whether it's just feeling a connection to food? And so, I mean, that's exactly why Linda's joined us here.
I feel like a lot of times the word sustainable is just thrown out there and everybody assumes it has a definition that is the same, and then it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to everyone. So what does sustainable mean to you, and more specifically to United Tribes Technical College?
Yep, that's a good question. Sustainability, I mean, it kind of means that we're going to be able to continue to produce this, you know, food, or this system is going to be able to continue into the future. That's sort of the big idea of sustainability. But how do we go about achieving sustainability? That's where I think we get a lot of different opinions about how we do that. And there you sort of have, like, the definition can be sort of less definite, right? So you have regenerative agriculture, which is, hey, sustaining the system that we have isn't enough. We need to actually build the system to have more capacity. I would say our approach here is, okay, I discuss with my students that, you know, this is a pretty typical way of looking at sustainability, is that there are sort of three legs of, it's like a stool, this sustainability. And the three legs are, you have the ecological leg, you have the social sustainability leg, and then you have the economic sustainability leg. I think a lot of the times when we say sustainable, we automatically think of the ecological component. So it's environmentally sustainable. We're talking about climate change. We're talking about ecological carrying capacity and those things. But the social and the economic are just as important, because if you take any one of those away, the whole thing falls over. And I think the one that gets the shortest shrift in the discussion is the social sustainability. And that has to do with, like, even something as simple as sort of farmer burnout, or it has something to do as simple as people don't care, you know, convenience, you know, we're too busy to care about where our food comes from. Those are all parts of the social sustainability. And that's where it's like, yes, community engagement. How do we make sure this is culturally relevant? How do we make this part of our lives instead of just an abstract concept?
So walk me through the program.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. The students get to engage in an entire 12 months of growing food. Of course, there's all the ancillary. We're talking about food systems. We're doing the academic work. But the heart of the program is learning the skills to plan an entire season of growing mostly vegetables, like intensive scale vegetable style growing. Carry that all the way through planting, harvesting, weed control, pest management. And then all along the way, we have like a thread of sort of business management, sort of entrepreneurialism discussion. And then also there are two other parts. I have the students, the main part of what they're doing is there's the farming skills, but then there's this whole other community engagement component. So throughout the whole year, an event or a workshop or something that the students are leading in order to engage the community in what we're doing in growing food. It's like trying to get them to do that. And then they all also participate in a research program where they develop their own research question, carry out, you know, data collection and so on and so forth, and put together, you know, the paper at the end and disseminate what they figured out.
There's 7 billion people in this world. Can small farmers feed everyone?
I love that question. About 85% of the farms in the world are less than 5 acres or 2 hectares and run by women majority farms. So most of the world is being already fed by small-scale sustainable farms that are very diverse and also much more per acre productive. So they're more productive as far as producing food, producing not just calories, but producing nutrition. So that's an important thing to consider. We don't live off of calories. We live off of nutrition. So farms that produce nutrition is what we need. And so, yes, absolutely. And, of course, then we enter in the equation that we, as Americans, waste 40% of our food. Yes, we can feed 7 billion people on small farms.
How is your teaching influenced by the threat of climate change?
Well, I think that, for one, the students are keenly aware of the threat of climate change. So most of my students are, right now, are between the ages of 18 and, I think, 28. And they're absolutely aware of climate change. They've grown up with the idea of climate change as part of the reality that they're inheriting as they mature into adults. And so that is what they want to learn about. How do we create resilient systems in a somewhat unpredictable future climate? I think that it has to be part of the discussion, and it just is automatically. And also the people who gravitate towards concepts of sustainable agriculture are already keenly aware of, yeah, we're dealing with a different climate. There's another side of that too, is that there's an economic opportunity. There's the idea of carbon sequestration and carbon capture as a economic option for farmers. And so we also discuss that in class, like, hey, this might be part of that economic leg of the stool. This is something that could, in the future, reward farmers who participate in soil building activities that sequester carbon.
The difference between dirt and soil, what is that?
Well, I would say that my own definition, and probably the one that I use most often with students, is the idea that dirt is not alive, whereas soil is very much alive. I think that's a concept that as indigenous people, we've always recognized. There's actually a really cool study among seventh graders in the state of Montana in which they asked about various concepts of what's living and what's non-living. And almost across the board, Montana's indigenous students said that things like water and rocks and wind and soil were alive, whereas non-native students did not label those things as being alive. So I think we've always had this idea that the soil is a living being that we need to help sustain, that we need to not abuse, and that if we do that, if we treat this living being well, it's just like taking care of anything else, being the steward of anything else, then they will in turn take care of us.
I want to ask a question that is going to make me sound like a super jerk. I really struggle sometimes with the concept of having to teach other people common sense. And I hear in what you're saying that when you treat plants like relatives and when you recognize the world around you as something holistic and systems-based, and then you see another culture that ignores that, and then you have to sort of come in and be deferential and try to teach it, do you sometimes just get irritated?
Well, yes. I've actually had a lot of people tell me that I was born to be a teacher because I, even like within the realm of social media, where, that can be very difficult because you often have a lot of people who their sole purpose is to try to make you angry. But I really feel like my goal is to be patient and to be understanding, just like I am part of the system and have not been able to escape what the system has taught me. I try every day, but I'm not completely free from it. I drive a car, for example, and use fossil fuels. I haven't been completely able to tear myself away from that system. So why would I judge someone else for being a part of that system and for believing in that system because it's gotten them this far? And it's scary. Change is very scary for people. And so I just always try to be really understanding of that. I'm always aware that if they are a part of that system, they probably have not fed themselves in a spiritual way. And I mean that in a very literal sense. So when I think about food, you know, we talk about food sovereignty, we talk about sustainability, we talk about food security. A lot of people are feeding themselves food that feeds them physically. It gives them plenty of calories, but it does not feed them emotionally or spiritually. So I'm very patient with people who are lacking that. And I believe that if I can help to encourage them to eat spiritually and to think about what they're eating and to think about what's putting in their bodies, that I will make them better and then make the world better. And eventually I will not get angry at people as much.
What do you mean when you say food that feeds people spiritually? Do you mean saying grace?
Not necessarily. When I say that, I mean that literally. I do think about a Twinkie, for instance. How close is a Twinkie to its origins? A Twinkie is made from sugar, which probably at one time came from sugar cane or sugar beets, but it's come very far from that. The outside of it, the cake part, probably was at one time something resembling wheat, but it has gotten very, very far from that. There's no spirit left in that Twinkie, basically. But when I eat the foods of my ancestors, when I eat corn that came from seeds that my great-great-grandmother was growing, and she was probably thinking of me, imagining me, dreaming of me as she planted that corn, I believe that corn feeds me spiritually and emotionally, nourishes me in a much different way than, say, a can of whatever brand-name corn they sell at the store now.
Realizing that a lot of ceremony is sacred and deeply personal, would you mind sharing some of your ceremony when you are working with your plants? And is it involving a prayer, a blessing of the seeds?
That's a really good question, because as an Indigenous woman, of course, there are things that I do every time, you know, whether I am going out harvesting food, teaching students, whatever, or even preparing it. I actually call those protocols. I'm trained as a scientist, a Western scientist, but I'm also always cognizant of the fact that I'm an Indigenous scientist as well. So I have a set of protocols that I follow when I harvest plants. I have a set of protocols that I follow when I prepare them. I'm always singing to my food. I'm always praying over it. I'm always making offerings, whether it's tobacco or some other thing that I've created. We have a concept of spirit plates, where we always take a tiny bit of every bit of food that's on the table and offer that plate of food to our ancestors, to the spirits. I think all of those things are really important to connecting us to our food, not just physically connecting us to our food, but spiritually, mentally, emotionally.
How do you describe your relationship with food?
I have a very close relationship with food because I've been an organic vegetable farmer mostly for the last 10 or 15 years. Having myself struggled to have a successful business that was producing food for people, good food that I felt good about feeding people, and the economic struggle of that and then the social struggle of that is that, you know, the truth is that you have to make trade-offs. The world forces trade-offs upon you. Even though, you know, I could look at something and say, hey, this is the most ecological decision to make to produce this bed of carrots, okay? However, to do that would take me three times as much as long. So if it takes me three times as long to do it, then not only is there a social consequence because now I haven't gone inside and taken care of my children, there's also an economic consequence because now I'm not doing something else that's going to earn income. And so, hey, you know, I have to pay the mortgage, I have to do this or that. And the reason I think that's such an important discussion is because those are the same set of circumstances that every single food grower has to deal with in our society, whether you're an organic grower or whether you're a small grain grower who has, you know, 5,000 acre farm. It's really the same set of decisions. It is very important not to like cast judgment on somebody else's decisions because they're dealing with the same issues. Maybe they're making different decisions based on whatever tools they have. It's very important for us to take a holistic view and say, how do we engage community and people back into the food system to the greatest extent possible? Because that starts to change what your options are about these trade-offs that you have to make. If you're trying to be a farmer who grows one person growing food for 1,000 people or whatever, which is like what we have today, which is sort of held up as this wonderful achievement of Western society, the downside is that you have 999 people who have no connection to their food, so they're not even getting that, they're not being spiritually fed. But also you have a farmer who has to make all these decisions that are not necessarily in the best interest of the future of ecology, of our society, et cetera, because that's the reality.
Ultimately, decisions like this rest in the hands of consumers. You can grow as many organic tomatoes as you want, and that's great for your family. But if people aren't buying it, like you already mentioned, that economic side that you have to consider, how would you characterize the Bismarck Mandan community in terms of supporting small-scale organic subsistence agriculture?
Well, that's a good question. As an organic vegetable farmer, well, as I described, trying to make a living from growing vegetables, we were fairly successful. But we were often confronted with this issue that you have people who are growing vegetables or raising chickens for fun and then want to sell it just to kind of make up some of the you know, that's fun too, actually. But they don't actually have to pay for their expenses because it was all just done as for fun. So this is an issue for small farmers across the country. So somebody's selling their backyard eggs for $2 a dozen, and they cost $6 a dozen to produce. And you're a farmer, and you care that it costs $6 a dozen to produce your eggs, so you're selling them for $7 a dozen. How do you compete with somebody else's eggs? Because they're subsidizing them with their own job or whatever. So this was something that I used to find frustrating. But then, having stepped away from that, I recognize, so you're talking about the Bisman community support of local agriculture. One of the things that is really strong in North Dakota is the amount of home gardeners that are here. People grow food here more than they do in lots of other parts of the country. And that's actually one of our great strengths. So while the economic side of it, trying to carve out a living as the independent person who's going to produce the vegetables, it comes with its own set of challenges. On the other hand, you have a community of people who really likes to grow and share their food. And in a way, they've sort of taken the economics out of it, which it's sort of a beautiful thing. You know, it's kind of like, oh, let's do that. Let's talk about feeding each other instead of feeding agriculture or feeding the system, you know. I think that's one of the strengths of the community, and that's part of why it's like, let's focus on community engagement. Of course, money and economics have to be part of the conversation. I mean, we're not suggesting it isn't, but oh, you know, maybe we can be creative about it. So, community gardens, community initiatives, sustainable ag degree programs, whatever it is, you know, in order to produce food for our community, and so that we can kind of ask a different question, I guess.
How would your grandma feel about this program and about the work that you do?
Oh, gosh. I think that she and her contemporaries would probably be really thrilled with the direction things are going. I just think there's so many incredible things happening. And we were talking about the number of students who are part of the ag program, and four students sounds really small, but that's four potential food producers in the state of North Dakota. I mean, if you think about it, potentially huge impact on our food systems. That's four indigenous students who are going to be educated, well-informed food producers, you know, who will have that ability. One person can change the world. Imagine what four indigenous people can do. I think that my grandmother and, you know, all the people around her are looking from wherever they're looking and are probably really, you know, guiding us still and are probably really happy and impressed with what we're doing now.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
That was Brian McGinnis, the land grant director and a faculty member in the Sustainable Agriculture and Food Systems Program at United Tribes Technical College, and Linda Black Elk, the Food Sovereignty Skills Coordinator at UTTC. Still to come on Main Street, an appreciation of the typewriter. But first, this news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. There are still a lot of unknowns about coronavirus, but Dr. Doug Griffin, the chief medical officer at Sanford Fargo, says new information about COVID-19 is expanding daily. Griffin says a model done by the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Health examined the recent outbreaks in China to determine if it's possible to get an idea of what could be expected in a location with a population base similar to North Dakota.
More of a medium case scenario would be 550 cases or so, and worst case scenario would be 3,600 cases. But the bottom line is that if we all follow the CDC's guidelines, we can flatten that curve and make an impact in reducing these numbers and keeping them small.
Griffin, other health experts, and metro area leaders held a briefing to discuss updates on efforts to contain the pandemic. The chairman of the North Dakota Public Service Commission says representatives of three investor-owned utility companies, Xcel, MDU, and Ottertail, have been communicating with the commission on their plans for customers during the current coronavirus pandemic.
I think we have a good plan going forward to ensure reliable service continues.
That's PSC Chairman Brian Crosius.
The plans do include easing of shutoffs, for example, for select individuals that may find themselves in that unfavorable situation. So they're very cognizant of that, not adding one more uncertainty at the current time, and also waiving service fees for any potential late payments that may come in as a result of people just focusing on other things at this point in time.
Crosha says he doesn't see the need for the PSC to adopt any temporary rules to deal with the situation.
I like the approach we're currently taking, which is voluntary compliance, if you will, and actually driven by the utilities themselves as much as by request from the commission. So I look at this as a good example of the partnership that we have with the IOUs working together through times like this and their understanding of the situation as well.
Public Service Commissioner Brian Crosius. A Grand Forks pizza restaurant is giving customers something that's been fairly difficult to find in recent days. Rhombus Guys says that with every delivery order, customers will receive a free roll of toilet paper. A Rhombus Guy employee says there are plenty of rolls to give away. The offer is good until the toilet paper is gone and only available at Rhombus Guy's Grand Forks location. Coronavirus-related panic buying has made it difficult for retailers to keep toilet paper on store shelves. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And it can be difficult to love something with a name like choke cherry, but they are quite delicious, and it turns out very good for you as well. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura talks about the choke cherry.
I've observed some large shrubs or small trees this winter with masses of what looks like hard black poop on the branches. That growth is black knot of prunus. It's a fungus, and as the name implies, grows on plants in the genus Prunus. I see this fungal growth mostly on choke cherry. That's no surprise, because that's our most abundant and widely distributed prunus. Choke cherry is a tall shrub or small tree which grows to a height of 20 feet or so. It can be found across the state in a variety of habitats, ranging from prairie hillsides and ravines to riverbanks and wooded areas. It suckers profusely, and as such often forms small thickets. It provides excellent food and cover for many species of songbirds, upland game birds, small mammals, as well as big game. And of course, excellent jams, jellies, and syrups can be made from the fruit, which became our official state fruit a few years ago. But back to the black knot of prunus. North Dakota's home to several native members of the genus, wild plum, pin cherry, sand cherry, and of course choke cherry. Introduced species such as Nanking cherry and dwarf Russian almond may also be found in the state, particularly in shelter belts. All these species are susceptible to the black knot of prunus. The black elongated swellings or black knots on these branches and twigs is often about an inch in diameter, may grow to several inches long, and are composed of a hard mass of fungal filaments or hyphae with spores which can be released and carried by the wind to other plants. And because choke cherry and other prunus species are so susceptible and widespread in the region, black knot is also widespread. Despite being attacked by black knot and several other diseases and insect pests, choke cherry continues to be used in shelter belts and is a popular ornamental. It's well adapted to our climatic conditions and tolerates a wide range of soil conditions. And its value to wildlife and fruit production are also important factors in its continued use. But black knot is often a major problem, particularly in lawns and similar situations. It's not only unsightly, it can reduce fruit production, and in cases of heavy infestations, trees may become stunted and deformed. It's perhaps the most significant factor limiting the economics of commercial chokecherry production in the region. Infested branches should be trimmed promptly and properly. So you might want to check with your local horticulturalist or NDSU extension agent if you have concerns about black knot. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support is provided by St. Rose Care Center in Lemoore, providing skilled nursing care, short-term rehabilitation, assisted living, outpatient therapy, Alzheimer's and respite care, home care, and hospice services. A member of the Benedictine Health System, strosecarecenter.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and many of you likely know that Tom Hanks and his wife Rita Wilson have tested positive and are in quarantine with the coronavirus. Well, we're thinking about Tom Hanks and his love of typewriters. For more than a century, typewriters were mass-produced in both the U.S. and abroad. In the digital age, of course, manufacturing for typewriters, well, pretty much came obsolete. Working typewriters can still be found. In fact, Tom Hanks says he has one with him right now in quarantine. He is not the only lover of typewriters. Michael Keller is a collector with more than 80 typewriters to his name. He is a professor of English and the coordinator of composition at South Dakota State University. And he's part of the Brookings Public Library's Typewriter Project, which launched last month. He visited with Lori Walsh from South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment.
Professor Keller, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I happen to love typewriters, too, so we probably could have scheduled an hour for this conversation. When did your interest in typewriters really begin? And specifically, I'm thinking, like, begin and then re-begin, because we all kind of banged around on typewriters when we were, you know, coming up and had to do our homework on them, people of a certain age. And then you fell in love once more.
Yeah, I've always liked typewriters. I kind of enjoy the history of modes of inscription. And really, I started collecting about 2 years ago, and it was kind of an odd circumstance. I was digging around in my basement, found an old typewriter, and I thought, oh, you know, this thing is still in pretty good shape. I should get it refurbished or at least cleaned. And that was going on while a friend was telling me, you know, you can buy these on eBay. I had never been on eBay.
Right.
Many thousands of dollars later, I'm quite familiar with eBay, Etsy, and other sites where you can purchase these machines. it's been an accelerated period in terms of typewriter collection. So I've acquired 87 in a little less than 2 years.
So history of modes of inscription. Tell me how the typewriter fits into that history broadly.
Well, if you go back to, I mean, obviously there are implements like, you know, pens and pencils that go way back, styluses and so on. But I think after Gutenberg invents the printing press, people started thinking about ways of having type available to them privately rather than having to go through someone else with a concern. We don't really have any kind of record of what people were thinking about in the 15th or 16th or 17th centuries in this regard. But we do have the first record of the first patent, which was issued to one Henry Mill in England in 1714.
Wow.
And really after that time, people are designing plans. The first typewriter was constructed, as far as we know, in Italy in 1808. And then in America, really starting in the first third of the 19th century, and for the 40 or 50 years from that time to when the first, essentially the modern typewriter was invented, there are lots of drafts, designs, some prototypes are built and so on. So increasingly it becomes something people are thinking about. And I think as the capacity for manufacturing increases through the middle of the 19th century up to and past the Civil War, these dreams can be realized.
It revolutionizes business in more ways than one.
Completely revolutionizes business, especially in relation to women entering the business place.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be fair to say that women wouldn't have entered the business place without the typewriter, but it certainly facilitated that. And one of the reasons that women were much sought for typing positions is that businesses would pay them less.
Sure. So tell me a little bit, though, about how women entering the workplace in those kinds of numbers, even though they were paid less, that's still controversial to pay them anything at all, right? People were afraid they were taking money away from hardworking fathers and husbands.
Right. The money that women would earn was viewed as essentially frivolous. It was for their own private purchases, pin money. So there was a concern that this would take jobs and money away from men supporting families. There were concerns that being in the workplace would defeminize women. And of course, there were concerns about flirtation and titillation and so on. And there is a rich literature of postcards, trading cards, books, and so on that represent, let's just call it hanky-panky in the office.
Sure.
And the word typewriter actually initially refers to the person who types. It's only later that it's assigned to the machine itself.
Oh, that's fascinating. All right. And it wasn't really, I don't know how old you are, but it wasn't too long ago that if you knew how to type and knew how to type well, that was sort of considered. I mean, there were a lot of men in journalism who couldn't type and were proud of it. If you're a woman who knew how to type, there was an assumption that you should be able to. So the gender implications of typing before everybody had a cell phone, they didn't go away quickly.
No. And it's kind of interesting. There, some of the typewriter manufacturers, Underwood is one in particular, used to sponsor national typing contests.
Yeah.
And both men and women would win these. And the winner would typically type 150 words a minute. But the challenge itself wasn't 4 or 5 minutes. It was an hour.
Oh, wow.
They typed at that rate for a solid hour, typically on a standard machine. And for anybody who's typed on any kind of typewriter, but especially some of these bigger machines, you realize you need some strength in your pinky
right.
in order to do this. And, you know, one of the oddities of my own collecting typewriters is that I also don't know how to type.
Oh, fascinating.
I type with two fingers, but I'm pretty fast.
Well, you know, if you haven't typed on a typewriter for a long time, you might type with two fingers, too, because, you need some pinky strength that we probably no longer and might not be worth spending the time to build. tell me about the typewriter project at the library and sort of how that's going to kick off.
Well, I approached one of the librarians who's a former student of ours in the English department at SDSU, and she was receptive to this. And part of what I have in mind was just a display of typewriters. I have some going back to the 19th century that I think people would get a kick out of seeing. And the technology is quite a bit different, so they don't even look like contemporary typewriters. The keyboard is different.
Yeah.
And also there have been in a couple places. One is a bookstore in Ann Arbor, and then in the streets of St. Louis, people have put out typewriters for public typing. So this is something that we're going to do as well. We're going to screen a quite good movie called California Typewriter. I will make some remarks before the screening. The film itself, it's a feature film. It's about an hour and 45 minutes. It features typewriter enthusiasts like Tom Hanks and Sam Shepard, playwright Sam Shepard, and probably it's the last footage of Sam Shepard. He died shortly thereafter. And David McCullough gives a very warm and convincing testimony for the wonders of the typewriter.
Yeah.
And Tom Hanks, who's actually a major collector, he has about 300 machines himself, and he's featured in the film. So there's kind of a history of the machine. There are testaments from enthusiasts. And the film overall is actually a kind of saga about one typewriter repair shop in Berkeley, California, which at one point is in danger of going out of business, but they managed to pull it together. And the shop is still operating. They now have a web presence. And my guess is they're doing pretty well.
So I use typewriters and have used them in my work. Well, I have one typewriter that I've used in my work and in teaching in the past. What do you love about? Why is it a revival now that people are sort of like claiming ownership of this typewriter revolution? We just have about a minute left, but if you could address that, please.
Sure. Well, I think there are two reasons. One is just the sheer aesthetics of typing. It's fun. And I think there's just a lot of presence to the machine itself. The kind of crisp report of a typeface hitting a platen is, I think, far preferable aesthetically to the kind of thin ticking of a computer keyboard. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a room full of whisperers. Of course, the other reason, the main reason, is people are very concerned about the digital environment, surveillance. And, of course, the manual typewriters are not plugged into anything. And in fact, now the intelligence agencies are using manual typewriters.
Of course they are.
for in-house correspondence, they will type something up, walk it down the office, hand it to the recipient, that person reads it, and there's no electronic footprint.
That's exciting. All right. Well, there's room for a resurgence of typewriters, as in people, as well. I might have a second career after retirement. Everybody will be looking for people with those skills. Michael Keller, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Michael Keller was visiting with Lori Walsh from South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment. Keller is part of the Brookings Public Library's typewriter project. Coming up next on Main Street, Recovery Reinvented.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. More than a third of North Dakotans view drug or alcohol addiction as a moral failing rather than as a disease. Jenny Olson is the managing director of the Office of Recovery Reinvented. And as we learn in this Prairie Pulse excerpt with host John Harris, it's an initiative to reduce shame and stigma attached to addiction. It grew out of North Dakota First Lady Catherine Helgus Burgum's own struggle with alcoholism and sobriety.
As she will share, she struggled with addiction to alcohol and, you know, was leading a very successful career. Point being, like, addiction doesn't discriminate, and a lot of times you don't know the stories that people are carrying around. She would be one of those examples with a successful career and a lot of friends, and tried many times to find recovery and start over. And after several relapses, finally found a program that worked for her and has stuck with it and worked very hard and is now channeling all of that experience to help others find the courage to seek help and find the hope that comes with recovery. And since she became First Lady, found that there may be a reason for all of this, and this is her chance to impact so many people.
And with that said, in the 2 years, I guess, that you've been with the program, what kind of results have you seen?
Well, number one, people keep coming up to us, you know, at events and talking about how they just feel like the vibe is changing, the culture is changing. It is a conversation and a discussion that people are having. And that's what we've been asking for. Bring this conversation out of the shadows. Addiction is a disease and not a moral failing, and we need to start treating it as such. Whether it's the workplace, in schools, in our criminal justice system, from all angles. And we have been able, through a series of initiatives and programs, kick off some really innovative initiatives that have brought this to the forefront. Whether it was the Youth Ending Stigma Challenge that we launched, which worked with all the schools across North Dakota and offered up basically a grant to all of these different student groups. Pitch your idea for how you will eliminate stigma of addiction in your school or your community, and we will give you money to implement your program. And we had 17 schools participate across North Dakota. We've got an initiative in the workplace, recovery in the workplace right now. We did a $50,000 innovation competition, which was like Shark Tank for recovery. So many cool things happening that we hear from the public, you know, these needs, these are public, and we get to respond quickly. That's a really fun environment to work in.
I understand that drugs are involved in about over half the arrests in North Dakota. Can you talk about some of those numbers?
That is true. Drugs and alcohol are involved in, I believe it's over 50% of the arrests in North Dakota, and 75% or more of the incarcerated population has some substance use disorder or mental health condition. This is an opportunity to give huge kudos to the state of North Dakota. Their behavioral health division, the Department of Corrections, our legislators understand that we need to treat this problem at the root cause and get these individuals the help that they need, because you can't incarcerate away this problem. And so in North Dakota, we have a very innovative free through recovery program, which helps those individuals who have been incarcerated get more access they wouldn't otherwise have to treatment and recovery resources for the substance use disorder or mental health conditions. And that has been proving very successful, reducing recidivism rates and creating a healthier population, returning to society productive citizens.
I assume finding help can be tricky in rural areas for this, but can you talk about the treatment options that there are around the state?
The fact that we are a state that is 50% rural definitely helps shape the conversation around addiction and recovery. And it's something that we talk about when we visit with other states around the country that is very unique to North Dakota. And one of the ways that we are trying to address the fact that we're a rural state is the behavioral health division in the state right now is working on setting up the Medicaid process so that we can get more services that are community-based services and in-home services, because we're not going to have a treatment facility in every small community. And we're doubling down on a strategy called peer support specialist. That means somebody who has a lived experience with addiction and recovery can go through a training, become a certified peer support specialist. And these individuals are all over the state. We've already trained over 200. Data has shown that it is a very successful and helpful model for helping an individual through their treatment and recovery journey. So getting things like these peer support specialists all over the state in a rural state is very key. And building things like recovery community organizations and all the different little communities across our state is also going to be another key point to address this in a rural state. Mm-hmm.
Do we know why, you know, addiction happens? I mean, is it something that triggers in the brain?
There is a ton of science, and we know a lot. A simple Google search will teach an individual so much. But very simply put, the drugs and alcohol affect the dopamine levels in the brain, and it essentially rewires the brain, essentially hijacks the brain's decision-making capacity. And it tells the brain that drugs and alcohol are the highest priority. And so things like food, housing, water, even taking care of one's own children can get sidelined by that hijacking of the brain. The beautiful thing is, though, that it can be treated, it can be managed, and that brain can get healthy again. And that is one of the messages we try to share. There is so much hope and possibility for recovery, and we just need to get people the chance. One of the saddest things that I learned when I started in this job was that a majority of the people who are struggling with a substance use disorder, only 1 in 9 reach out for the help and the treatment that they need. That means there's a whole bunch of people struggling that likely aren't raising their hand asking for help because of the shame and stigma. That is what we're trying to change. So those individuals all get the help that they need because recovery is so possible.
That stigma surrounding people who've maybe admitted they failed or they don't have the willpower. So how do you get beyond that?
The stigma is very real, and we're seeing it as a barrier to so much, whether it's finding housing, finding employment, you're a business professional with a family to support. You're afraid that if I say I need help, I'm going to somehow lose my job. It's going to affect my income. Then I'm not going to be able to take care of my kids. The trickle-down effect is so dramatic. It affects every facet of an individual's life in ways that I wouldn't have even realized until started living in this work and seeing it firsthand. But one of the things we do when we travel around the state, challenge some of those misconceptions, especially in like things like the workplace. Sometimes the unknown biases, that is exactly what we're trying to tackle, and we're absolutely making progress on that dimension.
What should family or friends do if they suspect someone needs an intervention?
Number one, listen. Listen with open, caring, empathetic, without judgment, knowing there are many paths to recovery, and then go find the professional resources. There is so many resources out there. Reach out to your local community groups. go online and learn about it. There's so much to learn.
Well, Jenny, we wish you the best of luck with this, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
That was Jenny Olson, the Managing Director of the Office of Recovery Reinvented. Prairie Pulse airs Fridays at 7:30 Central on our television service. Dakota Datebook is next.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 18th. Theodore Roosevelt spent about a year in Dakota Territory, adding up all his hunting and ranching visits. He visited Medora in 1883 to hunt bison, then he returned to try ranching. He had two ranches, Chimney Butte, south of Medora, and the Elkhorn, deep in the Badlands, north of town. On this date, in 1886, Roosevelt arrived in Medora for his longest visit to the territory. Bill Sewell and Wilmot Dow, who managed the Elkhorn Ranch, met Roosevelt at the train station. The next morning, they set out in a horse-drawn wagon for the ranch. The party had to cross the Little Missouri River 11 times and arrived after sunset. As Roosevelt said in a letter to his sister, "the full moon flooding the landscape with light." Roosevelt planned to stay for 5 months, during which he would write and hunt, but he would also have two of his most storied moments in Dakota. He would engage in his famous pursuit of boat thieves down the Little Missouri River. His party faced river ice, bitter cold, and dwindling supplies, but they captured the thieves, whom Roosevelt marched into Dickinson. This period also saw one of Roosevelt's great early speeches on the 4th of July in Dickinson. The 27-year-old New York lawmaker was the keynote speaker for the celebration. After a morning parade and other community events, he spoke at what is now the lawn of the Stark County Courthouse. One observer described Roosevelt's high voice as between a squeak and a shriek. But Roosevelt made his point, saying, "Like all Americans, I like big things. Big prairies, big forests and mountains, big wheat fields, railroads, and herds of cattle, too. Big factories, steamboats, and everything else. But we must keep in mind that no people were ever yet benefited by riches if their prosperity corrupted their virtue. It is of more importance that we should show ourselves honest, brave, truthful, and intelligent than that we should own all the railways and grain elevators in the world." He stayed after his speech to watch horse races and then returned by train to Medora with newspaper editor A.T. Packard, who suggested that Roosevelt could someday be president. Roosevelt said, "If your prophecy comes true, I will do my part to make a good one." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Coming up tomorrow on the show, we share an excerpt from the Prairie Public documentary, Women Behind the Plow. And the tour de force who created the Women Behind the Plow project is Sue Balcom. She joins us, of course, on a weekly basis to talk about Main Street Eats. This time, it's not something you should eat, but something you should be using regularly all the time, but especially now. She teaches us how to make soap. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day. And don't eat the soap, but do wash your hands with it.